Welcome to the Stabbin' Stylists Podcast. I'm Randa.
And I'm Ashley.
We are just two stylists who love true crime and hair, and we're going to tell you about both.
This is a true crime podcast. These stories may be disturbing to some. Listener discretion is advised. I just went on a long rant about ponytails, so that's what you guys get to hear now. It's summertime, and I know it's hot. Well, it's not summertime yet. It's about to be summertime. It's summertime in my heart, always. But be responsible with your ponytail usage, guys. Your messy buns, all that stuff. Be responsible with it, because you will break your hair, and we can tell. We can tell. When you sit in my seat and you're like, I have all this breakage. I don't know why. And I'm like, that's from ponytails and messy buns. And you're like, I don't do it that often. And I know that's what it's from. I'm telling you, that's what it's from.
Right.
Like that's so don't put it up super tight. Use scrunchies.
Scrunchies if you can.
Get silk pillowcases. That will just do wonders for your life in general.
Add a serum into your routine if you have to put your hair up often, like an oil one.
Don't put your hair up wet. Don't swim with your hair in a ponytail and just leave it up wet.
It's better to braid it if you're going to swim. It's less tension. It evenly distributes the tension better. Be a responsible ponytail wearer.
Trigger warning, this episode contains graphic crime.
All right, guys. So, last week was wild. We went over Phoenix City and the Phoenix City Machine, which literally encompassed an entire town in Alabama. And after that was taken over by the National Guard and they kind of shook stuff up, a lot of those people moved. And a lot of those people moved down to the state line in Mississippi and Tennessee, which is Alcorn County, Mississippi, in McNairy County, Tennessee, which is just like Columbus was with Phoenix City. Like, they're just right there next to each other. So first, we are going to start with a man named Will Hathcock. He was born in 1878, and his dad was a farmer, but he actually made whiskey on the side. And they ended up moving to Tennessee, where his dad ended up teaching him all kinds of skills, two of which included making whiskey and beer.
Okay.
They lived in Tennessee, but they were having to go to Corinth, Mississippi to get all their supplies. So the dad was like, fuck all this. I'm just going to open a store right here so we have everything we need. Opening the store also worked perfect for him because he was in the whiskey business. So... Right. He could sell, you know, his wares out of his shop. He married Mary Jane and they had 9 children. And Mary Jane was literally like true farm wife, quiet little woman. Will would farm for the store and he would make whiskey and beer for the store. All of the kids came and helped out. Well, around 1914, rumors started to like trickle down that the internal revenuers were cracking down on illegal whiskey and the prohibition was starting to kind of be talked about and become a thing. And by 1920, the Prohibition Act became law. And that's when Will was like, okay, our farm is still in Tennessee.
Right.
So we need to move a little bit closer to our store. So they pick up, they move closer to their store. And he becomes really good friends with the local police and the county sheriff because they bought whiskey from him. Around the same time, the Tennessee Alcoholic Beverage Commission, TABC, in the Mississippi Alcoholic Beverage Commission, MABC, were starting to form. And the first plan of attack they had was to figure out who was buying large amounts of sugar and corn mash. And Will was actually required to keep records of his sugar and corn mash sales because they were wanting to figure out that's what you needed to make these alcohols. So they were like, well, first, let's figure out who's buying this shit. And then we can kind of work it out from there and figure out who's making it. The thing is, he grew his own stuff. So he didn't have to keep the same records as people who got it to come in. If you received 40 pounds of corn mash, you would have to log, you sold 40 pounds of corn mash. Well, he makes his so he can actually bring in 80 pounds, but then say he only had 40, only report 40 of it. Yeah. So it just works out. Like
have however much he wants and report only a little
bit. Right. So he's really got kind of a good monopoly going here. He started figuring out with other farmers how to help them do the same thing. And he ended up arranging sugar deliveries and kind of started getting into it with this Biloxi wholesaler. So he would store all of this sugar on his farm from this wholesaler. Then he would divvy it out to people under the radar. So then people are being able to get their corn mash and their sugar without the government ever knowing that they're getting like these massive amounts. This young man by the name of Nelson Timlake would pop into the store and they'd sit around and smoke Cuban cigars and play poker. And Will sucked as a poker player, but Nelson was real good. They became little best friends. Nelson owned the tavern across from Will's store called Timlake's Tavern. But in spring 1917, Nelson went off to World War One. And while he was at World War One, Will found a friend that had some land that was like 23 acres between Tennessee and Mississippi. It was 15 acres on the Tennessee side and 8 acres on the Mississippi side.
Okay.
And so Nelson comes home from war and he's like, let's build a nightclub here. Let's do this. But the man wanted more money.
So we got all the ingredients.
Right. But the man wanted more money than what he had saved up at the time. So he starts doing poker games. To make the money, he starts going to Memphis and Phoenix City, Alabama, doing poker games, raising money. And he kept his money in a lot of different banks around the area. And in 1929, he's like, all right, this is time. I'm going to buy this land. I've got the money saved up from these poker games. And then October 1929, the stock market crashed. He went to the banks to get his money and the bank's doors were locked. There was no money. The only thing he had was $1,000 that he had from a poker game he had recently did. They never recovered from the crash and he never got all of that money that he had saved up to build his club. Right now, that'll have to be on the back burner. And then Will still has his general store and he starts having people come in asking for credit and, you know, not paying their credit. People didn't have jobs. It was a really, really hard time. And so they kicked up the bootleg whiskey operation. They actually would get some shit down from Canada and sell it by the half pint. And people were able to afford that a little bit more than the whiskey they had been making before. That's the way that they got out of the depression was through Canadian whiskey. So at this point, Will's kids are starting to take over. His son, Jack, was just absolutely his favorite. Jack had dropped out of school by the fifth grade, and he didn't really want to work at the store. He wasn't really good at reading and writing. At the time, there was no resources for him. By the age of 12, he was already transporting whiskey and moonshine by horseback to secret locations for his dad. And in the summer of 1933, Jack was fishing at a little creek on the edge of town. And some boys cornered him and beat him up. So he went back to the family store and grabbed 2 quarter sticks of dynamite, fuse, and blasting caps. And he went to the main boy named Junior's family farm and crawled on all fours into the outhouse, pulled a hammer out, and pried a board back at the base. Once he had a hole in the back big enough to stick his dynamite through the hole, he left and went back home. Early the next morning, he got and he had the 2 quarter sticks of dynamite. a long stick and bailing string. At 6 a.m., Junior, the bully, went out to the outhouse. As soon as he heard the door latch, he lit the fuse, caught the string on fire, but the dynamite fell into the waste below. It didn't stay in the hole. It fell into the waste below. So it blew up and blew Junior into the air with his pants down. So he goes running back home and starts laughing about it. Like, he's like, huh? And everybody's like, what was that big ball of fire? And it did not take them long to be like, Jack absolutely did this shit.
Oh, yeah.
So they sent him to a year in the Jordania Nashville school. That sentence was suspended on the stipulation he didn't get in trouble for a year. He was fined $25, which was the cost of building a new outhouse. Then he was sent home. The boy's dad said, you've always been a good friend and neighbor. I think Junior needs to replace that outhouse. Tell Jack the next time, don't use so much dynamite, as he shook Jack's dad's hand and walked away laughing. But at 12 years old, Jack was already blowing up outhouses, the boys that beat him up. So by 1934...
I mean, it's extreme, but it's funny.
I think that was hilarious. Now, if the dynamite wouldn't have fallen, would he have actually, like, blown the boy up? That's probably a little bit extreme. Yeah. But blowing up the outhouse was, like, honestly, best revenge I could think of.
Right.
I love it. So by 1934, Nelson married a woman named Kay, and they ended up buying the land right there at the state line. He would spend several hundreds and thousands of dollars, and he would build the State Line Club and employ many, many people for gambling and liquor. He also started the construction of the Rustic Inn right in Mississippi. And then his bootlegging partnership with Will was bringing in several hundred dollars a month. On May 12, 1934, Will comes home one day, and he sees his wife in the outside in the fields farming. She doesn't have dinner ready for him. So he comes in and he like flies into a rage that she's not cooked dinner, and he throws her to the ground and threatens to stomp her. So the oldest boy, his nickname is Izdu, he stood up and he like got in between him and was like, nuh-uh. So the dad pushes him up against the wall and Jack hurries and gets his mom. The dad pulls a knife, lunges towards the oldest son, and he ended up getting away from him. He picked up his pistol and he whipped his father with it until his dad was like slumped on the floor in a pool of blood. Him and his siblings and his mom like take the dad's gun and get the fuck out of there, right? So the next day, they're all at the oldest brother's house. The mom, the kids are hiding from the dad, and next thing they know, the dad pulls in. And little did they know that the dad had borrowed a pistol from one of his friends. And Will Hathcock opened the car door, looked his child in the eye, pulled his gun from his pocket, and unloaded it into his son's chest. Right as he did this, the other brother stepped out, pulled his pistol, shot the dad in the head. Everyone saw this happen, including Jack. The brother ended up surviving until the next day, but the dad was dead on scene. This all happened before Jack was even 14 years old. So Jack goes on a crime spree, and he starts breaking into houses and robbing them. And before, he was kind of like a little bit more extroverted, and after, he becomes really introverted. He's kind of a loner, and he's even really called cowardly. And he avoids conflict and kind of does sneaky things like blowing up an outhouse instead of confronting people head on.
Like, he's going to get his, but it ain't going to necessarily be in front of your face.
Right. So a judge finally sentenced him back to the same boarding school for a year for stealing a Bowie knife, but he was home in 8 months. And now he's working at the store with his brothers because they kept the store and they're like, well, if you're going to be here, you're going to come work for us. By the time he was 16, they asked him one night to take a liquor delivery to the State Line Club. Jack goes to drop it off, and Nelson before has like only let him drop it off at the back door, wouldn't let him in. Well, this time Nelson actually lets him inside for the first time. Nelson had just hired a waitress named Laura Louise Anderson. She went by Louise, and she was a 17-year-old Southern belle with beauty, brains, and sassy. She had moved to McNairy County whenever the stock market had crashed back in the 30s. And by the time she was 18, like, girl had dreams. She said, I'm not going to be poor. This is not going to be my life. Like, I'm going to have something one day. And she just stuck with that her entire life. Every man that came in flirted with her, and she flirted back with him just as equally. And Jack was just smitten with her, but he wouldn't talk to her. Finally, one day, she was just like, listen, I don't buy it. What's a girl got to do to get a drink? And he literally just said, nothing, what do you want?
Nothing, what do you want?
So romantic.
Oh, yes. But in just a short few months, they actually ended up getting married. She actually wasn't too keen on marrying him because she wanted more than just being a waitress. And at this point, she was a bookkeeper for the club, too. But she just wanted more. Like I said, her whole life was driven by wanting more. And Jack promised her, one day I'll own this club. Like, stick with me and I got you. One day we will own this club. Louise says yes, and they're married October 3rd, 1937. Jack lied on his marriage certificate saying he was 21 and she was 19, but she was only 16 at the time, or 17, and he was 16. Just less than 3 years after they're married, she was already messing around on him. She was already sneaking off, and one day she ran off with a sailor. Everybody knew she did this except for Jack. So Nelson finally came to Jack one day and was like, listen, this is embarrassing. You need to do something about it. She has, you know, stepped out with this sailor, and these kind of shenanigans attract the kind of attention that we don't need. I sent my boy Clyde following, and I'll tell you that they're in Blytheville, Arkansas, staying at this man named J.W. Hostess. Here's the directions. You need to do something. Jack gets his best friend, George North, and George is a huge character in this story, too. I mean, he stays by Jack's side for forever. They go to this house, and George ran around the back as Jack went through the front door. Louise was screaming at the top of her lung while Jack drug her out of the house. The old lady hostess that lived there was, like, holding her hand over her mouth, just, like, didn't say shit, just sat,
like, oh, my God.
Yes. While Jack pushed Louise in the back seat and George climbed in the back seat, holding her down while Jack closed the door. And as they were driving, Louise managed to get away from George and jumped out of the car while the car was going 35 miles an hour. Obviously, this hurts her. So they grab her and they take her to the hospital. She had a concussion, internal injuries, severe scalp lacerations, and broken ribs. They worked on her and put her in an ICU room to figure out what had happened when they contacted a man named Sheriff Jackson. They told him, something's going on here. Please come check on this lady. So when he walks into the ICU unit, there's two, like, super dapperly dressed men waiting in the waiting area. And he's like, okay, who are you? And Jack says, this is my wife. You know, I'm her husband. And she fell out of the car. All George did was introduce himself and say he was just along for the ride. So the sheriff was like, you don't leave. I'm going to see the doctors. And he was like, deputy, you stay with these two, right? So the deputy, Jack told the deputy that he needed to make a phone call. And of course, he called Nelson and told him what happened. And Nelson said, don't worry about it. I'm on my way. Nelson and his bodyguard, Willie, stop at his office. They grab $20,000 in cash, some shells for his gun, and they're out. All right, let's go get Jack. So Jack handed the deputy that was guarding him a wad of $100 bills and said that he just needed 10 minutes head start, to which the deputy said, okay, get out of here. So the sheriff comes walking into Louise's room, and I mean, she's black and blue all over, her blonde hair stringy with dry blood. She looks real bad. And he says, okay, what happened to you? And she says, Jack threatened to kill me on Monday, and I left and came and stayed with this family. And he abuses me. He treats me like a slave. He's absolutely horrible to me. Well, at the same time, Jack and George are dipset. They are dashing off to the car, and they're out of there. And as they're going through West Memphis, two motorcycle cops pull them over and ordered them out of the car, found their pistols on him, and arrested them for carrying concealed weapons and reckless driving. The sheriff goes back to the waiting room and he's like, hey, deputy, where are those men? And he says, they're in the bathroom. So they wait a few minutes and wait a few minutes and they walk into the bathroom and find the window just open. So
my God, they've escaped.
They're gone. So the sheriff goes and talks to Miss Hostess, the woman's house that Louise was at. And she said that Louise had not been staying at her home long and that her son had brought her safe home, like safety to their home, because her husband was going to hurt her. She went on to say that she did not know Louise and that she was a worldly woman and did not feel like her son should have brought her there. And when the sheriff said why, she said, and I quote, well, she cusses like a sailor and had a pint of Old Crow in her purse and was sipping from it. She smokes like a freight train and she tells a sad story, but she was promising my son things a married Christian woman would never do. She tells the sheriff that her son was in the army and he was just home on leave. He stopped at the State Line Club on the way home and that's where he had met her. And then he went back and just left Louise there. The sheriff goes back to his office and realizes that Jack and George had been arrested by the two motorcycle cops. So later that afternoon, he gets two warrants and goes to the men. Whenever he returns to his office, Nelson comes walking in and said, I came to get my boys, pointing at Jack and George. And Nelson smiled and reached into his coat pocket and pulled out a wad of $100 bills and said, go down to the Rustic Inn and get the biggest steaks for you and the miss. I'll catch you later.
Oh, my.
He left with them. So then he drove them to the impound lot and got their car and just sent them home. He turned his Cadillac around and he went and stayed in Blytheville for the night. He got a room and he actually played poker and had prostitutes and whiskey all night. And then the next morning he went to see Louise. He told her, you will not say another word about this incident. You will drop charges or they will find the smallest remnant of who you are. Get your damn things and get in the car with Willie, his bodyguard. And don't you dare cause any more trouble. Do you understand? I do not need a slut in my club. Either you straighten up or you will disappear. I want you to know what you've been doing behind Jack's back, and I'm here to stop it now. A nurse entered the room and said it was time for her to take her medication. Nelson looked at her and said, how much do you make in a week? And she said, $75 a week. And he said, you need to get Miss Hathcock to Corinth. And she needs a nurse to travel with her. I will pay you $200. You leave today. You'll be back tomorrow at the latest. The nurse said, I'll have to ask my supervisor, which worked because it was actually an old pal that Nelson had been in the army with. So he said, okay. And Louise was transported back with Willie in the ambulance with her, and all charges against the men were dropped. He had the club's bouncers watch her every single move, and they weren't even allowed to get close to her. But at the time, she was smart. She had goals, you know? So she studied the operations around her. Plus, she was doing the books and she was studying the moonshine runs. And she watched and she studied hard how they worked. She knew one day she was going to take over. Then World War II happened. Obviously, at this time, the whiskey demand dropped because all the 18 to 30-year-olds had been drafted off to war.
Right. They're all gone.
And then not just that, there was ration books, restrictions on sugar, flour, wheat. And so it was getting to be a really hard time. The club owners were getting fined and taxed by the state every time they found the whiskey on premises.
Yeah.
Whiskey just wasn't selling the way it used to. So they started kind of looking into maybe prostitution. Same thing as Phoenix City. Most of the local politicians were paid off to look the other way. So when someone would complain about anything, nothing was ever prosecuted. And during this time is whenever the club started getting a lot more shady. Nelson continued to grow his empire and would actually bring in card sharks and crap dealers from Phoenix City, Alabama, to run the gambling for him as he was purchasing more property and starting to build more clubs. The news the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor happened. And before the news had even finished airing the segment, his phone was ringing with the National Guard saying that he was getting deployed. So he meets with Jack and he's like, listen, I have somebody to cover all of my clubs but the State Line Club, and I don't know what to do. And Jack's like, well, I mean, let me do it. And Nelson was like, well, you know, it would really need to be somebody that could pay me cash for partnership. Everybody else is partnered into this. Like, I'm not just going to leave you my club. Like, if you could partner into this, then maybe. So Jack drove back to the old farm that he grew up on in Tennessee and came back with $20,000. He had said that he had saved most of it. Some of it was his dad, but he had just buried it out there and had the money. So he goes back to Jack and he's like, hey, here's the money. And Nelson says, okay, that works, but I'm not just leaving you in charge. Clyde, my nephew, and Kay, my wife, are also going to be part of this while I'm gone. He also took Jack up this long, dark road, like a quarter mile back, and said, I want to buy this land. So by the time I come back, you make this happen. And since you're going to be a partner in this club, Louise can't run the books anymore. He'd say, I'm going to bring a girl from the rustic inn to do the bookkeeping. Jack doesn't like confrontation. So he went on and ordered a couple of like big burly bootleggers that he knew to be bouncers for him. He's also calling in friends from Biloxi, St. Louis, Dallas, and Chicago to like keep a eye on these clubs, especially the State Line Club, because he doesn't completely believe that Jack can do this. He just honestly does not think that Jack is ruthless enough for this. January 11th, 1942, he's sent off to Japan and he's gone for 18 full months. And while he was gone, Jack ran the State Line Club like it was his own. And he was really good about taking advice, though. Like, he didn't just completely take over and run it amok. He took other people's advice. But there were still robberies, shootings, stabbings, all the same kind of stuff that had been there before. And in 1942, the sheriff made a special trip to visit him and told him off the record that there had been 67 charges filed on patrons leaving the club. And, you know, you really, really need to slow it down some. April 17th, 1942, Jack and Louise were eating supper with Clyde when a fist fight broke out between a man named J.W. Smith and Cordell Levis over a poker game. After they fought a little bit, Levis sliced Smith across the chest with an 8-inch blade. Blood soaked through his shirt instantly and started to drip down to the floor. He stepped back a couple of feet and pulled out his gun. George stopped them before either of them could do anything, and they started to pull him outside of the parking lot at the same time that the cops pulled in. So the cop pulls in and he's got his gun drawn. Louise rushed out to distract the deputy while Jack and Clyde got everyone inside and all the whiskey hidden. So they take the man to the hospital. They take one of them into jail. And the next day, the sheriff's reviewing the charges for the State Line Club. He had dropped the ones against George, and he was really just like, I told you, you need to calm down. On the way to the club, he fell in behind an old pickup truck with a big green tarp on it, with the back of it riding really low and dripping a liquid.
Gee, I wonder what's in there.
So when he pulled him over and he asked where they were going, they straight up just said that they were going to the State Line Club. The man that was transporting it ended up getting in trouble and had $8,000 worth of whiskey on him that the police took. So he was bailed out for $1,600. So, I mean, that's a lot of money at the time. $1,600 bail, but they had still lost $8,000.
Dang.
So a few weeks later, a man leaving the club only drove a half mile before hitting another car head on, killing the driver. And whenever the sheriff investigated the crash, he found a pack of matches from the State Line Club. So the man ran from the scene, but was actually arrested later and charged with a DUI. And the sheriff ended up going to the club and like, listen, this is not going to work. So in 1943, violence just continues. A man named Clinton decided to rob a man named Dave. And as Dave took the last swig of his whiskey and walked out of the club, he felt a barrel of a .38 special snub nose in his belly. And the man demanded all his money. But even after he gave the money, the man still shot him in the stomach and then ran away. By this time, they were ready to boost income and attract more patrons. So that prostitution was already doing good for him. Let's make it even easier by setting up some small camping trailers and set them up behind the club. Now they have all of these trailers behind the club, and Jack was like, you know, I'm going to start opening my own places too. So he adds Jack's House of Suds, later Foam City.
Okay.
The Rainbow Room, the Shamrock Motel, and the White Iris. But most of the time, his clubs would just burn down mysteriously. But Nelson, on top of owning these clubs, was also a professional gambler. So he also had clubs in Biloxi and in Reno, plus some, you know, locally, the State Line Club, the Rainbow Room, and the Rustic Inn. But by 1947, Jack's properties had ownership were in, like, real serious trouble with the beer licensing board. The sheriff recorded 88 felonies from 1942 to 1947 directly involved by his clubs. So he had all of Jack's beer license removed. Nelson made sure to take Jack off of all of the records of the State Line Club and replace him with Louise.
So he just swapped him out, basically.
Basically, but now... Because, yeah.
Like, she's not going to draw anything.
Right. And now, this is what Louise has been working for, you know? This is what Louise has wanted. Louise is still flinging around behind Jack's back. She's still having a fling or two going on.
Okay.
So, one day he came home to a note saying that she had gone to see her sister Dorothy in West Point. He called and Dorothy said she hadn't seen or heard of her for days. So Jack jumps in his car and he drives around looking for her and he finds her car parked at Lloyd's Cafe, but she wasn't in it. He's making rounds and he drives back down by Lloyd's and sees her getting into her car. We followed her home and he pulled in behind her. She started in the house. He followed her. They got into a screaming argument and she pulled out a gun from her purse and shot at Jack, hitting him the right shoulder once.
Okay.
The other two bullets blew out the glass of his car windshield. And so he falls to the ground. He's bleeding. And in sheer panic, she realizes that Nelson is about to fucking kill her for that. So she loads him up in the back of the car and drove him to the doctor, like the mob doctor's house. And the doctor patched him up, no questions. She was begging Jack, please, please, please do not tell me. And he said, I won't tell you. She was just, I mean, having an Emmy-winning performance, nursing him and babying him whenever Nelson showed up. But Nelson still didn't completely trust her, so he made George go stay over there for a few days because he didn't like Louise. He didn't trust Louise.
Not a fan.
So among these 88 felonies, here are a couple real fucking crazy ones.
88?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. In 1945, a man named Clifford was hanging out at Jack's House of Suds, gambling with a man named Earl. And he had beat Earl in several hands of poker and asked him, you know, hey, pay up. But he didn't even have the money on him. So he followed him home to get the money. Well, when the man went to his house and came out, he had a shotgun. And so Clifford hit Earl upside the head with a metal pipe. Earl crashed to the ground. Then Clifford shot Earl with his own 12-gauge shotgun.
I feel like that was probably not smart.
A brawl broke out at Foam City and ended in a double homicide with Percy White and George Walker being sentenced to 2 years for prison for manslaughter. And even though Jack had lost his license in 1947, 1948 found him pumping bootleg whiskey and beer over the counter like it was nothing. Like, it did not hurt his sales whatsoever.
Yeah.
So, because he had just had Louise apply for a beer license in her name, the prostitution business out back is doing good until a wife shows up. Local newspapers report the incident of a woman named Minnie Holt attacked an employee of Foam City for taking care of her man in ways she did not approve. The fight between the two women was like watching two bear cats fighting over a territorial dispute. Not one man dared breaking it up. Well, by this point, you know, Louise is one tough bitch and doesn't care anymore. And she would carry around a ball peen hammer in her apron to break up fights. But not only to break up fights, she would also use it to rehang the pictures that had been broken after the fight.
Okay.
Dual purpose. So finally, Louise gets her hammer and goes out there and starts wailing on the ladies to break them up. They escorted the women off the premises and they called the sheriff and the ambulance for them. But Minnie did not mince words. She told the sheriff what happened and why. But she was still arrested for assault and malicious stabbing. As if there's ever a not malicious stabbing.
That's what I'm saying. Like, I don't. Okay. Okay.
At this point, the sheriff's like, this shit's got to go. We got to get something done about this. Him and a deputy go to the State Line Club and they meet with Jack, Louise, Clyde, Nelson's nephew, Kay, Nelson's wife, and Nelson. They all sit down at the table and Clyde hands two envelopes full of $100 bills in front of the lawman. Just lays them down, right? The sheriff said nothing and the deputy kind of peeked into the envelope and pulled one of the $100 bills out and tore it in half. Then without saying anything, he pulled out another one and he tore it in half. He kept doing this until Kay finally just pulled the envelopes back. Like, we get it. That's enough. The sheriff had just won his election for second term as sheriff. He was actually called into courts not long after for the investigation of bribe taking and accepting, which was sent in by anonymous tips. He wouldn't take their bribe, but they were like, we're going to say you're doing it and we're going to get you out of here. But they ended up clearing him of everything and he stayed in as the sheriff. So Nelson, around the same time, set up a big poker contest in Purdy, just over the Tennessee line in McNairy County. This was on some property that he owned because he owns it on both sides. The players came from all over and he set the stakes high with some games going for $2,000 to $5,000 pots. Into the second day of the tournament, the wife of one of the players who lost complained to the sheriff's office that her husband had been cheated out of all of his weekly wages on the game. That gave the sheriff, you know, another light to do something. He went and got warrants and he took several deputies and he raided the poker players and he arrested 22 of them. So at this point, the sheriff starts going literally door to door for support to tear down these clubs. And after 2 years of legal wrangling, he managed to get an injunction to close the State Line clubs. All the club owners were summoned to appear before a judge in November of 1948. So the owners start scrambling to move all their liquor and all the items from their clubs just in case he ends up finally locking them out. The sheriff's department, armed with 33 search warrants and court orders, literally padlock the clubs.
They locked it the fuck down.
Yes. So after they padlocked the last door and the sheriff went home, he found his dog dead hanging in a tree.
No, yes. Not the dog.
One of the deputies walked into his woodshed for firewood when a rifle projectile whizzed through the shed. They were getting threatening phone calls. They were having windows broken and sugar poured into their gas tanks of their patrol cars. And they even called in the highway patrol to help the fucking police, like to keep the police safe. They're like, these motherfuckers are crazy. By 1949, Nelson calls Jack and he's like, I need to sit down and I need to talk to you and Louise. He tells them that he is wanting to move on from the clubs. He's not wanting to do the clubs anymore. He's a gambler and he's invested in casinos in Biloxi and Reno. And that's what he wants to do. And he arranged for Jack to take the State Line Club, Foam City, and the Rainbow Room. So the next day, Jack, still desperate to have Louise love him, drives her into a new subdivision and turns into this newly constructed house that he had built just for her. At the same time, Louise's brother has a baby that he can't take care of named Susan. She wants to be a mom, so Louise and Jack adopt Susan. And Louise is over the moon. She's got the clubs now. She's got the house. She's got the baby. To have all that, she loves that. She'll deal with Jack. I'll deal with you being around as long as I can have all this stuff. Jack and Nelson had set up several buyers to purchase the whiskey that they had stored to keep the money going. And Nelson's attorneys won the right to reopen State Line Club, the House of Suds, Foam City, under the condition that they did not sell alcohol. Nelson hired people to look out for cops and the law enforcement by giving them World War II type walkie-talkies, and they had them up and down the road up to 5 miles away. They would actually even police the parking lots, checking car tags to make sure that, like, nothing looked official, because, I mean, they knew that they were going to trust in spies, too. So they were on top of it. They were pretending to be good guys selling hamburgers and sandwiches, but they had a locked back room that they, like, hid all the tables for gambling for. They hired local bands for dancing in the clubs and tried to make it look like these normal businesses. April 1949, W.O., who is Jack's nephew, and Pee Wee Walker purchased a small amount of beer and they hid it in Jack's House of Suds. Suds, not studs. That sounds like strip club.
Mm-hmm. That sounds like a different kind of club.
And the young men were caught selling the beer to minors. One of the mothers caught the son, took him to the sheriff's office. Sheriff's office was like, where'd you get this? Of course, he's a teenager. He immediately said, Jack's House of Suds. They go in, they arrest W.O., and Jack is pissed and goes and bails W.O. out. Well, now Jack's House of Suds has violated the court order. He might get padlocked again if he doesn't keep it going. So he calls Nelson and told him the problem. Then Nelson calls a judge. He started tightening security and actually started screening people coming in and out, making sure that these are okay people, that this isn't going to happen again. Nelson took W.O. and Pee-wee to the side and told them, you need to follow directions. You're going to wish you would have. W.O. goes to his dad, who's Jack's brother, and is like complaining about this. And he says, son, you better listen to Nelson Timlake or I'll be reading about you in the obituaries.
Oh, my.
So I've read multiple times that Nelson Timlake was a very background character. Like, he tried to fade into the background, but he can absolutely be called the godfather of the State Line Mob. Like, he really was the one running shit in the background.
Yeah.
By January 1950, Jack and Nelson had bribed enough people. They had all the clubs back up and running with the gambling, the drinking, the prostitution. The ploys would often rob the drunken patrons, or the hookers would pillage their pockets before sending them on their way, and they would make up to $2,000 to $5,000 a night.
That's like a ridiculous amount of money.
Or 1950.
That's what I'm saying.
You've got to even think paying $500 fines, that $500 was even a lot of money back then.
Oh, yeah.
So imagine the amount of money that they're paying out in fines and bailing people out of jail and all that stuff. But one night, one of the lookouts fell asleep. So the sheriff and his deputies raid them. They go in. Jack and Nelson escaped the raid, but they were given bench warrants. And they both faced 3 counts each, up to 6 years in prison. But they went in, turned themselves in, and only got $500 fines and suspended 6-month sentences that obviously they knew these judges, so they knew they weren't going. But Nelson was like, I'm fucking done. At this point, he was over it. He relinquished his partnership with Jack, and Jack got all the properties of the club. Clyde and Kay retained a little bit of an interest on some of it. But all the properties were deeded to Jack because Nelson's like, I already told you, I'm a gambler. Like, you're getting into way too much shit here. I don't want anything to do with this. Jack just cranked up the music, brought in more gambling, drinking, all that. Like, he really just honestly cranked it up a level. They said that Jack did not care about no beer laws. He'd just pay the fines, go on. He was fine. The sheriff received a complaint that people were seeing beer bottles all up and down the road right there at the State Line Club, and people didn't like it. So they got a warrant. They went to serve it. And right as they walked in, Louise was handing a beer to a customer. So they arrested her. They shut them down, and she paid $250 fine with a suspended 90-day sentence. Howard Carroll and Pee Wee Walker decided to cut gambling profits by bringing in slot machines to this place called the Dusty Star Club. And the sheriff kind of actually ended up helping them because he did shut them down, and they actually were sentenced to 30 days in jail and fined $500. That helped the State Line Club to grow even more because the sheriff actually did take down his one rival that he had going. On April 4th, a fist fight broke out, and I mean, it was bad. They were fighting back and forth. There was brass knuckles and guns and everything, and they said that there was blood everywhere. By the time the police showed up, Sheriff Kirkpatrick walked in and he said, did the fight start in here? And Louise snapped, Sheriff, does it look like the fight started in here? There was no blood on the floor, nothing broken or out of place. What they had actually done is, as soon as all this happened, Jack calls his buddy George. George shows up. He gets the two guys. He takes them off to the mob doctor. And then clears out the bodies, and it's all cleaned up by the time the police show up. So in November, Jack's sister Pearl called, and she is screaming, I killed that son of a bitch. I killed him. He shows up, like, what happened? And she said, I stabbed him, the rotten bastard. She's sitting outside. She's covered in blood, and she's crying, and she says, I'm okay, but he's dead. So Jack rushes in, and she sees the husband in, like, a pool of blood with a large butcher knife literally sticking in his chest. Whenever he goes back out, Pearl's crying and Jack says, what happens? And she says, he hit me. And Jack asked where? She said, in the stomach and knocked me down to the floor. Jack said, the cops are not going to buy the story because you're a Hathcock. And without hesitation, he swung and hit her upside the head with his fist, breaking her nose, fracturing her jaw, and giving her a concussion. He then dragged her into the house and dumped her on the floor next to Charlie in his pool of blood and said, Charlie attacked you and you shouted him. That's your story. He called the police and reported Charlie being killed. He told them what he knew. They loaded up Charlie. They took Pearl to the hospital. They checked her out. They released her and nothing ever happened. By December, W.O., the one that was selling the beer to the underage kids, he came back and he's like, I want my job back. You know, this, please just have me back. And Jack's like, no, I don't have time to raise you and you cost me money. I don't have time for that. The nephew said, I'll tell Dad what you just said. And Jack reached in his pocket, pulled out a gun and put it between his eyes and said, I will let you tell him. I will tell him for you. W.O. peed his pants. And he left, and he decided that he was going to get revenge on Jack. 2 days after Christmas, Louise answered the phone at 2 a.m. and yelled for Jack. Someone burned down the State Line Club.
Oh.
Jack arrived at the scene to see that it was completely gone. He went to Jack's house of suds, which I'm pretty sure was just next door. And he found a full can of gasoline sitting at the back door. Flagged down a deputy and actually told the deputy what he found. The deputy went to the Rainbow Room to check it out to make sure it wasn't on fire, too. He could never prove that W.O. was the one that set it on fire, but yeah. He paid people to sleep at the clubs from there on out. Stuff was just getting worse between Jack and Louise. Like, it was not getting good, and Nelson figured out that W.O. was the one that started the fire. So stuff kind of seems like it's starting to get unraveled here. Jack decides that he's going to build a new club on the spot where the State Line mob was. And he thinks that it will make Louise happy if Louise can take care of it. So Louise calls it the 45 Grill and they build up this awesome place that she imagines. At the same time, the sheriff's department had been given a tip about the little trailer city behind Jack's House of Suds. They actually ended up going in and raiding the little trailer city, as they called it, and they arrested several women and their Johns. All of this was going on at the same time the 45 Grill is opening up. And Jack really found that empowering Louise running the 45 Grill did not do what he thought it would. Louise became more belligerent and would just act like a total nightmare to all of these people. She would command orders at people. She actually ended up taking fleecing to a whole nother level, that she would have the waitresses keep the men drinking and rubbing up against them, thinking they were going to get lucky, and then would have them rob them by taking them out to their cars, doing whatever they had to do, but get all their valuables off of them.
Rob them nonetheless.
And she's still carrying her little ball peen hammer around in her apron pocket. And every time someone would get into a fight, she'd just pop them directly on the head. One of these fights actually caused $1,000 worth of damage, and 5 men were charged with felony assault. The men came and paid off the damages and everything. But by the end of May that year, after the damages and bills, they had made $9,300. They actually started adding extra guards, helping that, you know, this would help to cut down on the violence. It really didn't. There was one night that one of the Johns had beat one of the girls so bad that they ended up killing the guy and just dumping his body. Jack really liked the money that these prostitutes were bringing in, but after especially the girl was beat up and a couple of them got arrested for robbery, he just kind of decided, we're doing really good with the 45 Grill, so we don't really need this part of it anymore. And they really attracted a lot of people that he didn't need there. So he actually cut back on that a lot. In March 1953, local celebrity from Phoenix City named Fannie Bell Green came to visit, and she said she had 2 boys that needed jobs. This is how Barry Smith and Carl Toehead White came into the fold. Now, Toehead wasn't just regular kind of gangster, right? He was actually known as the Al Capone of Alcorn County. He was made a bouncer there. He actually used to drive the car for one of the actual mob bosses. So this is something he had been doing for years and years. And he was known to be a rough tumble guy. So he was the perfect kind of person to be there. One night, Towhead is acting as a guard at the 45 Grill. And two men end up getting in a fight that Towhead starts to break up. And he is actually cut 10 inches with a knife. This is the same night that a man was basically trying to call out one of the craps dealers for switching out cards, and he was being belligerent. So Louise came out with her ball peen hammer and just boop, directly on his head. Jack started pistol whipping the man. The next day, the man went to the sheriff, and Jack and Louise were actually arrested on attempted murder this time.
So they just said, now we give a shit.
Right, basically. But of course, like always, they paid bail and got out. Jack ended up purchasing more than 200 acres of the state line between 1940 and 1964. Stuff was not going good between him and Louise. She would leave and then not tell him where he was going, just leave the baby there. She would avoid having conversations with him. She really didn't want anything to do with him. One night in October, a man received a call that the Stardust Lounge was on fire. And the fire chief came up and started talking, but noticed that there was like these two men standing there. As the men ran across the road, they were recognized as a man named John Folks and Towhead White. Later that week, George cut the brake lines on John's car, and at a high rate of speed, he hit a tree and was instantly killed. Around this time, Jack heard about this club in Nashville called the Uptown Club. They were actually drugging their customers and like rolling them outside, like stealing their money outside. So he started doing this at the 45 Grill. You would have thought that it would have been all the fighting and the drugging and the robbing and all that that would bring attention, but it was actually one pissed off guy with a slot machine that brought them down. He loses all of his money. The bouncer pulls a gun on him. He goes and he tells the police. And that is when state troopers and TBI agents get involved. And that's when they go raid Jack's House of Suds. Jack was hiding whiskey in the base of a big road sign across the street when he heard a bunch of cars pull into Jack's. So he hid behind the sign and watched as people were running out and as they were like arresting people. They arrested the manager for gambling and for having a gun. When they were arresting him, the guy screamed, "This crap belongs to Jack Hathcock. I just work here."
Oh, okay.
Jack was sitting there hunkered down watching them when he heard somebody say, "Put your hands up." And he jumped up and he put his hands up real quick. And then he turned around to see Pee-wee Walker standing there laughing. They just stood there and watched him load up gambling machines as they went walking across the street. He walks across the street and asks the sheriff if he wants to have a cup of coffee with him. He pays $1,500 for fines. And that's all that ever happens.
I mean, you can really just do whatever you want back then.
Yeah, they could, until 1956, when a man named Buford Pusser found Foam City exciting and decided to see what it was all about. And that's where we will start part two of the State Line Mob. That's just some of the violence and chaos there. I had to cut a lot of it out because I tried to tell all the little stories, and then I started thinking, God, like, they're all the same. They're all the same. People get robbed, people get shot, and then nothing ever happened out of any of them. But the State Line Mob. And Louise is actually called the queen of the State Line Mob. Her and Nelson Timlake are credited as being leaders of the State Line Mob more than Jack is.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And so it'll get crazy. Next week, Towhead becomes a big character. Buford Pusser. I've never seen the movie Walking Tall, but it's about him. And we'll see about the rise State Line Mob.
We've been to find out, y'all.
Don't whistle in the woods at night.
Bye, y'all.